Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent Judge Kavanaugh from serving on the court.
Women need to support women, and men need to support women. And Kavanaugh has proven that he is not ready for the Supreme Court. Vote him down.
Well, once again tonight, Brett Kavanaugh has broken sharply with the tradition of Supreme Court nominees and has decided to make another public statement outside of the Judiciary Committee hearing room, which is usually the only place that we ever hear from a Supreme Court nominee.
But I think that his performance during the hearings caused me to change my mind.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. So I tweeted this week that these confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh have been hell on the hippocampus, and they have. For those of us who believed the manifest evidence that Kavanaugh assaulted Christine Blasey Ford, and those of us who saw that Kavanaugh's incoherent and contradictory denials only provided more evidence against him, the pain of this week has come in reliving Ford's experience with Kavanaugh. And we've also been reliving our own experiences with sexual assault, silencing, and smear campaigns. For those who are in high color on Kavanaugh's behalf, because they think Ford bore false witness since she's a paid crisis actor, I'm not as concerned with their hippocampuses, but I'm sure they're looking pretty black and blue, too. On the eve of what looks like it'll be Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Supreme Court, I really wanted to do a show that would turn the temperature down and inject some cool rationality into a conversation defined largely by tears, menacing shouts, and a cacophony of animal pain. My guest to that end is Ben Wittes. He's the editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Wittes is very good with perspective and detailed but open-minded analysis in our turbulent times. And Ben's often downright chipper, as when one of the Mueller indictments comes out and he and the Lawfare gang convene to admire the prose and precision of everyone's favorite special prosecutor. Man, can we get back to the Mueller investigation? I will always resent that Brett Kavanaugh has kept me from enjoying the Manafort flip. And one day we will be back to that on TrumpCast. But today, Ben is joining us. And like the rest of us, he's not feeling as chipper as he is when he talks about Mueller. Wittes has come forward with great reservations to oppose Kavanaugh, whom he's known for a long time and worked with as a nominee to the Supreme Court. His heavy-hearted piece in The Atlantic is titled, "I Know Brett Kavanaugh, But I Wouldn't Confirm Him." This is definitely a plaintive ballad of a Trump cast, but it's a powerful one. Maybe it's a power ballad. Joining me on the line is Ben Wittes. He's editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His recent piece in The Atlantic is titled, "I Know Brett Kavanaugh, But I Wouldn't Confirm Him." You can look for it in the show notes at slate.com/TrumpCast. Ben, welcome back to TrumpCast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that I got to meet you in person. We are Twitter friends, but now we're real friends.
Yeah, and you're not just a disembodied voice anymore.
Exactly. All right, so let's start with the basics. We're all kind of wrung out from this week. I'm going to use a name that's going to surprise you, Brett Kavanaugh. How well do you know this guy?
So I don't really want to talk about the details of our relationship. But I've known him for a very long time, and we've kind of lived parallel lives in the issue sets that we've dealt with over a long period of time. So Brett was working on, for Ken Starr in the Office of Independent Counsel at a time that I was writing about the investigation for the Washington Post editorial page. And then he, you know, was in the White House working on judicial nominations and post 9/11 legal fallout when I was covering those issues after he went on the bench, which was around the same time that I came to Brookings. I started working principally on national security legal issues at precisely the time that the D.C. Circuit was hearing this very long and involved raft of Guantanamo habeas cases, which, you know, I spent a lot of time with. And so in a weird kind of way, we've kind of had very overlapping issue sets for a long time, and we've interacted quite a lot as a result of that.
And you're a deep thinker on these matters. So you're not just saying that you, you know, think he is an affable person. And I should say, even, you know, Dahlia Lithwick, who is to the left of you, has sort of stipped to the fact that Kavanaugh is, you know, is a nice guy. And you also found, at least your Atlantic piece says, you found that he also thought deeply about issues like habeas and, you know, impeachment and the pressing issues that used to preoccupy us before this president.
Yeah. So, I mean, I when Brett was nominated, I was delighted by that because not, you know, not because I would have preferred that President Trump be making nominations and not because Brett's judicial philosophy is especially representative of my own, but because within the universe of people that it was conceivable that President Trump would nominate, I couldn't imagine he would choose one better than and more open-minded than and more thoughtful than Brett. And so, you know, and that does reflect a lot of years of dealing with him on a raft of issues in which, frankly, I think he is a model of the kind of engagement that you would want from somebody who you agree with about some things, disagree with about others things, really disagree with about other things. And I have, as I say, dealt with him about a lot of different issues over the years, and I've always found him more than affable. I mean, he is an affable guy. He is somebody who it's, you know, fun to have lunch with and chat with. But he is a significant thinker about a lot of things that I care about. And I do think in these sort of polarized times when we're, you know, everybody has to be demon or saint, friend or fiend, for those of us who've come to oppose the nomination despite ourselves, I don't choose to forget the things that are attractive about him as a mind, as a interlocutor, and as a judge and thinker. And so I'm not going to run away from those things. I regret that I am in the position I am and that he has frankly put us all in.
I want to slow down for a minute and have you unpack for us what are some of the specific things that make you admire his work as a circuit judge?
Well, so he is, first of all, an enormously clear writer, and he's a very clear thinker. And, you know, one thing, agree with a Brett Kavanaugh opinion or disagree with it, you're never going to find that it's muddied or muddled. Hmm. In contrast, by the way, to the person he's replacing, Anthony Kennedy, who you can always wade hip deep into an Anthony Kennedy opinion and then find yourself stuck in the mud and trying to figure out what he is and isn't saying and what the basis for decision is and what the scope of the principle in question are. And Brett is very clear. His opinions are quite precise. Even ones that you disagree with intensely, you know exactly what it is you disagree with. And I think that's a virtue in a judge, honestly. Secondly, you would never know it from the display he put on Thursday. But his temperament from the bench, I've been to many, many oral arguments at the D.C. Circuit. He is a model of civility to counsel. You know, he lets people answer questions, which, you know, not all judges do. He is extremely well prepared. He knows the record very well. all of these things are, you know, to be counted as virtues in judges. And so, look, I think there is a lot to admire about Brett Kavanaugh.
So that brings us to the what you call in this Atlantic piece, sort of the other Brett Kavanaugh, or the Brett Kavanaugh that showed up for the hearing last week with Christine Blasey Ford. So what did you see that day?
I couldn't have been more shocked. And I know a lot of people, you know, particularly on Twitter, are making fun of me for being shocked. No apologies. I was shocked. And, you know, the person who showed up for that was highly partisan, undecorous, was not civil, and was conspiratorial, was not limited to facts. And I do not begrudge him his anger, but I do very much, concerned about and dismayed by the mode of expression of that. And I thought it was wholly unjudicial. It was unbefitting his current position, in my opinion, and it was certainly unworthy of elevation.
Retired Justice Stevens has come out against him. I think you found that dubious or even unseemly. And Brett Kavanaugh has come out in favor of Brett Kavanaugh on the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal. Did any of that do anything to change your impression of whether or not he ought to be confirmed?
Well, so let me address Justice Stevens's comments first. I don't believe that we defend norms by violating norms. And I think the norm that retired justices are very muted in what they say about the functioning of the court is a good norm. I think the expectation that current justices have nothing to say about this one way or another is a good norm. And I don't want to see any of that eroded. And so I know a lot of people were excited by Justice Stevens' comments. I was not, and I wish that he had not said what he said. I also don't think current nominees should be writing op-eds about themselves and their qualifications, and that's why we have hearings. If you are going to write an op-ed endorsing yourself, as you put it, I think it is a bad idea to, if you're part of the thing you're addressing is a suggestion that you behaved in a partisan fashion or that you comported yourself in a fashion that allies yourself with one ideological group, writing an op-ed in the organ of that ideological movement strikes me as exceedingly unwise. That said, I do think there were some valuable things that he said in the piece. For example, that he sort of acknowledged that some of the things that he'd said had gone too far and had been inappropriate and that he shouldn't have said them. And he acknowledged, furthermore, by the mere act of writing the piece, that he had reassurance to offer. There was some reassurance that he needed to offer people that he was going to behave like a judge. I do think it's actually sort of a good thing he had the desire to do that. But I don't think the op-ed is a good format for that. Having been a professional editorial writer myself, I love that form, but it's not the right form for that. And I think the only appropriate way of addressing that is, number one, if he gets confirmed, to comport himself in that fashion, in a meticulous fashion over time, is I think the only way that he will actually convince anybody that he's capable of that.
This time has been trying for people who hew closely to the kind of idiom that we learned in college that most people still practice in the Senate, measured, as you say, ideally meticulous, and even what J.L. Austin, the linguist, calls constative, you know, having something to do with reality. And this was clearly, I think Kavanaugh has turned in three acts of performative speech acts that were meant to spike cortisol. They were meant to rally support. They were meant to express anger. And these three were very Trumpian performances. And I'm thinking of the Fox News performance, first off, which was considered by many to be measured by contrast with the other two, except that it was on Fox News, which is not quite as fair and balanced as its old slogan used to say. Then he, of course, testified, and that was, you know, pretty off the rails, I think, by any standard. I even think people who liked the performance liked how operatic and furious it was. And then the Wall Street Journal one, which sort of split the difference, but was certainly defensive and in a partisan platform. So, I mean, I think this kind of performative speech, which, you know, belongs maybe in the Senate, is, I don't know what the justices say are making of it. I mean, this is so outside the norm that I think many of our minds are blown. And I guess to bring this around to a real point, do you think was there any point, aside from being sort of unprofessional and unjudicious, was there any point in that testimony after Dr. Ford's testimony that you thought was simply a lie, like could be held in relation to reality and found wanting?
So let me answer that in two ways. I do not believe that testimony showed the sort of candor that we should expect from somebody who would be a justice. And, you know, to know particularly what is a lie, you have to have an intimacy with the underlying conduct that actually very few people have, right? I did not drink with Brett Kavanaugh in his late teens or early 20s. And so his comments about, you know, his insistence that he was never blackout drunk, he was never out of control, I cannot say with any definity what the truth of that is, save that it is contradicted by a number of people who knew him at the time and who drank with him. What exactly they were trying to convey in that yearbook about one of their, you know, about Renata Dolphine Schrader with the term Renata alumni, I cannot definitively say what the answer to that question is, save that I don't believe that it was an innocent show of respect for an admired female friend, which is the way he categorized it. So, I mean, I am, you know, people throw around words like lies and perjury too blithely, and I'm not going to do that. I will say that I was very troubled by the candor of his testimony on a number of points, even assuming that he's telling the whole truth about Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. I am uncomfortable with his testimony about the sort of aggregate culture that allegation arose from, and I have a problem with that.
The court itself. So last week in the LA Times, I wrote about the prestige of the court and cited Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who I think his kind of closing statements the other day, I think, were fairly brilliant. And I've watched them a number of times because they were a dose of sanity. Like Amy Klobuchar, he was one of the senators who was directly addressed about his drinking and drinking game practices. And I think he responded the way you would have and most of us would have by kind of trying to preserve the norm of and the solemnity of the occasion by saying, you know, in response to "Do you play quarters?" he just said no, you know. And anyway, in addition to that, he also expressed his fear that the Supreme Court would become what he called a captured agency. He meant in service to he called them Republican special interests, which seems like a term from another time when you mean potentially far-right interests that posit conspiracies by the Clintons and uranium one ideas or whatever else he thinks that that Kavanaugh was gesturing at there. I mean, I think that's an incredible danger that we might have the prestige of the court take a hit if we have someone like Kavanaugh on it, who is going to have to really work to, I think, gain the trust of his fellow justices there. And maybe we'll take some modulation by Justice Roberts. What do you think?
Well, so first of all, it is important to remember that Kavanaugh has long prior relationships with all the justices. He has been one of the most assiduous circuit judges in sending his clerks to the Supreme Court. And by the way, that is a reflection of the fact that his, you know, his is a chambers that is a highly desirable one to work in. And the young law school graduates who come clerk for him are, you know, uncommonly likely to end up clerking at the Supreme Court. And in addition, you know, his recommendation is taken very seriously. And so, you know, there is a prior set of relationships there. Look, I agree with half of the premise of your question. Look, is it a terrible, terrible thing for the reputation of this court, at least among half of the population of the country, to have a justice confirmed in these circumstances? Yes. Full stop. End of question. It's terrible. The caution I would offer is I do think it's important to separate the ideological questions from the questions about his conduct in the court, both his underlying conduct and his conduct in the course of the confirmation process. Ideologically, philosophically, Brett Kavanaugh is a figure very much in the mainstream of conservative legal thought. When people say people voted for Donald Trump because of the court, or it was a big part of why they voted for, this is exactly what they were voting for. And so to the extent that the concern is an ideological concern about the direction that Brett Kavanaugh will vote or take the court, to that I say, you know, people go out and vote. Elections have consequences. If you don't like that aspect of it, you got to elect people who will do different things. But that's not an institutional problem for the court. That's actually the way the process is supposed to work. One other thing, both the Democrats and the Republicans have participated in that very actively. And I do think that, you know, people call out, and rightly so, Lindsey Graham on this. You know, when Mazie Hirono was asked whether she believed Dr. Ford, she actually said that she believed the substance of the allegations because of the content of Kavanaugh's jurisprudential views. And that is an outrageous thing to say. And to the extent the concern is that we are mingling philosophical differences with claims of misconduct, claims of non-judicial behavior, I do think there is a lot of blame to go around on that score.
When you talk about voters who, in the hopes that the court would move conservative, what instantly comes to mind in our cartoonish times is Roe. One of the things that people, I think, center and left worry about with Kavanaugh is not that he'll chip away at Roe, probably any Trump nominee would, but that he would extend Trump's pardon power. And in general, he has often voted in favor of, or shown his hand that he supports extended executive powers. And those things, I mean, I think you and I come together on the significance of the Mueller investigation and the very serious indictments against the Trump circle. And if Brett Kavanaugh is being used as a kind of a weapon to protect the president, or a shield of kind of yes, to protect the president. That seems to me more nervous making even than an assault on Roe. How about you?
So this is an issue on which I have, you know, publicly argued that people are misreading his writing. And I have, you know, early on in the nomination, defended his writings on this subject, with which I have, you know, some familiarity for, you know, since the days of the Starr investigation. And I do think they are being misread. I don't know what his current views are. The famous Minnesota Law Review article that everybody cites was originally a speech given at the Minnesota Law Review Symposium, I believe, in 2008. And Brett was the keynote speaker, one of two keynote speakers at that conference, and the other one was me. I don't believe that article says what people think it says. There is no doubt that he has pretty doctrinaire views about the appointments clause issues under Article 2, which bear on certain aspects of you know, the independent counsel law and the sort of famous Scalia dissent in Morrison v. Olson. And so I have no doubt that in that sense, he is a sort of executive power purist. None of that affects the Mueller investigation. Mueller wasn't appointed under anything like the independent counsel law. He was appointed on something that, you know, the crazier corners of the conservative legal movement notwithstanding, has no constitutional question about it at all. And so, you know, I don't really think that aspect of the set of concerns about Brett Kavanaugh do not particularly concern me. And I say that as someone who, as you know, is very deeply and daily concerned about the integrity of the Mueller investigation.
I want to get to the FBI report, and Kavanaugh and the people around him seemed to me to be powerfully opposed to a full FBI investigation. That, above all, is what surfaced in Kavanaugh's testimony and in the way Lindsey Graham and Chuck Grassley have handled this report. Graham is said to have taken a look at one page of it. None of them wanted it to happen. Jeff Flake made it happen. Then there's been curbs put on it. I mean, they seem to be quite afraid of some truth coming out, and that is very suspicious to me. So what do you think about how this FBI report has been handled? Do you agree with me that it's alone worrying?
Yes, but perhaps not for the precise reason that you just articulated.
Okay.
My view is that there are three major issues that were presented by his testimony. One was the underlying question of whether his version of whether Christine Blasey Ford's allegations are true or not. The second is whether along the way to denying it, he made significant material misrepresentations of fact with respect to his drinking and to his involvement in a certain culture. And the third was his comportment and, you know, what I think of as sort of unacceptable partisanship. I think it is almost unbelievable that there was resistance to the idea of the FBI investigating the first set of the first question. And the idea that was not immediately referred to the FBI for to figure out whatever you can find. And by the way, whatever you can find, given the age of it, given the fact that by her account, there were only two people who knew the assault had taken place, neither of whom has a particular incentive to admit it, you know, maybe what you can find out is almost nothing. But the idea that there was not an immediate interview of Mark Judge, of her and of him before the hearing strikes me as very inappropriate and a show of real lack of confidence in what the facts would bear out. I also think, and this is probably only evident after the hearing, that there is an important set of ancillary questions that arose about drinking. And that is not because I think it is appropriate to do a sort of roving inquest into Brett Kavanaugh's history of alcohol use, which I don't believe is appropriate to do, but because by way of defending himself, he made certain claims about what he hadn't done alcohol-wise. And those claims were immediately contradicted by a bunch of people who purport to know them not to be true, including most recently three of his self-described drinking buddies at Yale in a Washington Post op-ed last night. So I think there's, you know, that raises two issues, both of which I think would properly have been encompassed within a reasonably scoped investigation. One is, if in fact he drank in the fashion that she is describing in that piece, in her allegations, which he denies, that would tend to lend credibility to her story and would be an important corroborative component on its own terms. In addition, I do think when a nominee makes statements that a whole lot of people say, whoa, that is not true. And I don't mean people like observers like me. I reacted, as I said before, that, wow, I have a question about the candor of that. But I mean people who purport to know that it isn't true. And they say, that is not a true statement that he made in his confirmation hearing. I do think it is, at a minimum, very awkward to confirm somebody without reality checking those statements. And so I don't think this is the FBI's fault. As you know, I am an apologist for you know, the deep state, and I'm, you know, Glenn Greenwald once called me, you know, a courtesan of the power.
And, high praise, know, a, badge of honor.
Apologist for the national security state apparatus, and I certainly embrace all of those descriptions. But I don't know, and obviously I have not seen the FBI report, so I have no reason to think it wasn't professionally done within the confines of the time and scope limitations that the Bureau had, but I don't see how those time and scope limitations are reasonable under the circumstances.
I want to address the somewhat funereal tone that I don't think you and I have ever struck with each other. I haven't heard you sound this down on lawfare either. There's a certain, well, exhaustion from the cortisol poisoning of the two testimonies. I don't think I've ever like physically felt so activated by two different kinds of highly charged testimony. It just put you through the ringer that day to see someone describing trauma and sexual assault, and then another person, I thought quite a bit less convincingly and less sympathetically, describing being falsely accused. But both of those things, it just felt like, I don't know, it felt like getting divorced and having your mother die on the same day or something. I don't know. I probably need to look at why I found that day so upsetting. Then there's this certain tone of reluctance about having to come forward that Christine Blasey Ford modeled for us, but the Yale classmates and the editorial you cited also say, you know, it gives us no pleasure to do this. You know, they were his drinking buddies. These are people like who, you know, found him appealing, have affection for him, but that they need to come forward. Deborah Ramirez and Julie Swetnick, you know, whose testimony have not been kicked yet. We don't know how accurate they were, but they'd seem to also take no pleasure in coming forward. And then there's you, who, as you say, in general, you don't mind being seen as someone who, you know, is close to James Comey, who knows James Comey, and who's willing to sort of give support to what he says. And you know, and this time you feel the same way about Kavanaugh because your careers have been somewhat in parallel and shared interest in the same issues. But your piece just has a tone of such reluctance. And I know from you that this Atlantic piece sort of took a lot out of you to write it. And maybe you can tell me something about that reluctance.
Yeah. A few things on that. First of all, I would have happily sat this one out. And, you know, I don't, there's a lot of people who feel very entitled to other people's opinions. And, you know, there's a lot of like denunciation on Twitter and elsewhere of people who, you know, who've kept their own counsel on this subject or haven't, you know, spoken up. And I don't share that at all. I would have happily been one of those people. As I said at the beginning, I've had a long and happy professional set of interactions with Brad over a long period of time. I like the guy. I have published him on Lawfare. By the way, if you want an example of Kavanaugh being a model of engagement with people of other, you know, political orientations and jurisprudential orientations, read his review of Judge David Barron's book about war powers.
We'll put that in the show notes. Since it looks like he's going to be confirmed, it might do all of us good to see him at his best in that piece. Yeah. So you've published him,
So I mean, you know, would have happily sat this out as a bystander and somebody who just kind of watched agape, as lots of people have, except that I had vouched for his character in public before these allegations arose. And as a result of that, I was sort of understood as somebody who was, you know, kind of actively supporting him. And I had specifically said that he was not a liar, and I didn't believe he'd lied to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I didn't believe that he was, you know, that I thought he was a sort of, you know, quite apart from what you think about his judicial views, I thought he was a thoroughly decent and honorable person. And then he gave this, first of all, this allegation arose, and secondly, he then gave this testimony that, you know, I had real concerns about. And I thought, given that what I had said on the subject in public, I had a sort of more public obligation than some other people to, you know, grapple with how the record had changed. And so, you know, that was why I did that. Look, was I reluctant to do it? Absolutely. I mean, you know, I am differently situated from either somebody, much differently situated from somebody who claims to be a sexual assault victim, obviously. I'm also differently situated from somebody who knows the guy socially from, you know, from having been drinking buddies in college and feels a certain sense of civic obligation to, you know, describe what they in their own minds know to be untruths that he said. So I'm not a fact witness in that regard. I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, I'm somebody who made an argument based on what I knew about his character that was shown to be at least a lot more complicated than I understood when I made those comments. And So, I do think I'm differently situated from those people. I also think that I'm a more public person than they are. So that mm-hmm. certainly the costs to me are very different, very much less. And so I don't actually want to compare your comparison of their reluctance and mine. I'm not sure is quite right. My reluctance is just, you know, boy, I wish I didn't have to do this, but... Whereas I think, you know, they had this other thing. Do I want to thrust myself in the public eye in a way that I'm going to, you know, get torn down and attacked? And that's a very different set of questions. That said, if the question is, was I reluctant to do this? Yes, I was very reluctant to do it. And I, if circumstances had been different and I had not said the things that I'd said before these allegations arose, I would very happily have been somebody who just had nothing to say on the subject.
All right. To wrap up, I want to quote Christine Blasey Ford as saying, a lot of this seems to be, we'll find out, I guess, but indelible in the hippocampus these last couple weeks of the of the confirmation. I mean, Trump times, we've all been a little bit on fire since the election. But why is this more even than the border separations, Puerto Rico? Why is this one the one that feels like it's exerting some kind of trauma on people? I know what women are saying and feminist groups are saying, and I've been, you know, more people have been sexually assaulted than have even, you know, than have lived through a hurricane. So that may be part of why not Puerto Rico. Certainly more people have been sexually assaulted than have lived through false accusations of something like this in the public eye. Is that it? Or, you know, why is it running so hot right now? Why this in particular?
Speaking of things that are not my expertise, you know, political culture and sociology is probably mm-hmm. one of them. But let me give you a couple thoughts. So one is definitely the reason that you describe, which is that sexual assault is much more pervasive than a lot of people, certainly including me, understood before the Me Too movement. And having a Supreme Court nominee publicly confronted by a witness in that fashion and made to answer for it and doing so in these very searing terms that he did is clearly a major moment in its own right. And so that's, I think, part of the equation. Another part of the equation is that, and I think a lot of people who are left of center really do not understand this. But, you know, it is hard to overstate what people like Brett Kavanaugh mean to the conservative movement and the conservative legal world. And, you know, when Brett talks about, you know, the many clerks he's mentored, how many of them are women, he is not, that is absolutely true. And there is no analog in the liberal world to people like Brett Kavanaugh in the amount that the establishment of their political and legal movements invests in them over time. And, you know, the conservative movement has been grooming the Brett Kavanaughs of the world for moments like this for a very long time. And I mean that, by the way, not as criticism or as conspiracy, but as praise. I think the investment that the movement makes in the best of its people is admirable and frankly attractive. And Kavanaugh has been both the is one of the singular examples, there are others, of a person who has both been the recipient of that embrace and for the people that he has mentored and sent on to the Supreme Court and to great things in professional lives, also a source of that embrace. And, you know, it is very hard for liberals and center-left people and lefties to understand how upsetting it is to, you know, conservatives to watch a person like that be torn down the way, from their perspective, this process is seeking to tear him down. And so I think you have on one side of the equation this very deep set of traumas being explored and unearthed and poked at, and a lot of people being triggered. And on the other side of the equation, a very fierce and serious investment in that has spiritual and political and moral components all wrapped up into it, all, you know, all being attacked and made vulnerable at the same time. And there are, you know, I know this is hard to believe, but there are actually people who are experiencing both sets of traumas at the same time, because they have, I don't know how many feet people can be expected to have, but they have multiple feet in multiple worlds.
Maybe you among them.
Me definitely among them.
Yeah.
You know, I am torn up about this. I mean, I wrote what I wrote and I believe it. And I could, if I were a senator, I could not vote for Brett Kavanaugh. If you force me to say how I would weigh the evidence, I weigh the evidence in Christine Blasey Ford's favor. And I'm not comfortable with Brett Kavanaugh's performance at a partisan level, and I'm not comfortable with the candor of it either. And I said those things, and I stand by them. And if you ask me, am I heartsick about it to watch what has happened? Absolutely heartsick about it.
I just always admire how deeply you think about these things, and of course, don't let the tweet world get you down.
It's been a shitty week.
My God, I know.
This is the only substantial interview on the subject I'm going to do, and I very much appreciate your the seriousness with which you did it.
Thank you, Ben. And that's it for today's show. How'd you feel about the show? Let us know by tweeting at RealTrumpCast and tweet at me. I'm at Page88, P-A-G-E-88. We would love to hear your feedback. And what do you want to talk about next? What's important to you that's not getting the coverage you think it should? Let us know. Again, we are at RealTrumpCast. Our show today was produced by A.C. Valdez with help from Daniel Schroeder. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.